Welcome to today's deep dive. We are really so thrilled you're joining us.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks for being here.
Today, we are looking at the life, the work, and the incredibly complex legacy of Michael Bennett.
A truly massive figure in theater.
Right. And we've gathered this huge stack of biographies, historical reviews, old production notes to really explore a man who fundamentally revolutionized the American musical.
He really did.
And our mission today for you, the listener, is to explore how this one visionary changed Broadway forever. And he did it by focusing on the raw, unpolished, often painful humanity of his performers.
Yeah, that's the key.
And also how his relentless pursuit of absolute control ultimately mirrored the grueling realities he was putting on stage. So, okay, let's unpack this.
Let's do it.
We're talking about a theater director and choreographer who racked up 7 Tony Awards,
Seven.
11 additional nominations, and a Pulitzer Prize. I mean, it is just a massive legacy.
It is a staggering resume, but what is truly fascinating here isn't just the sheer volume of awards, it's how he achieved them.
Right.
Bennett didn't win by giving audiences the standard, shiny, Broadway perfection they were used to.
The typical glitz.
Exactly. He won by actively stripping away that traditional Broadway polish.
He took it right off.
He wanted to show the audience the sweat, the exhaustion, and really the terrifying drive underneath all that glitz. He essentially changed the entire vocabulary of how a musical communicates with its audience.
And it all started up in Buffalo, New York.
Yes, it did.
He was born Michael DeFiglia to an Italian-American factory worker father.
And a Jewish mother who worked as a secretary.
Right. And that intense drive we're talking about, it was there from the very beginning. I mean, he was staging his own shows as a teenager at his local high school.
Bennett High School.
Yes, Bennett High School. And in fact, he actually dropped out of high school as a teen to go on tour playing the role of Baby John in the U.S. and European tours of West Side Story.
Which is just wild to think about.
It's completely wild, just packing up as a teenager and hitting the road like that. And I love this little trivia
Oh,
detail.
about the name.
Yeah. When he decided to pursue a life in the arts and needed a new stage name, he literally just took his high school's name.
Just borrowed it right from the building.
Michael DeFiglia became Michael Bennett.
If we connect this to the bigger picture, it's crucial to understand that Bennett was not an overnight success story.
Not at all.
I think people often look at a towering figure like him and assume he just arrived fully formed, ready to win awards.
Right, like he just stepped onto Broadway, a genius.
But he had to endure the Broadway grind just like the dancers he would later immortalize.
He really did.
Throughout the early 1960s, he was dancing in shows like Subways Are for Sleeping and Bonjour. He even worked as a featured dancer on that NBC pop music television series, Hullabaloo.
Which is actually where he met his future collaborator and wife, Donna McKechnie.
Exactly. They met right in the trenches of the
Doing the
industry.
hard work.
Yeah. And when he first transitioned from dancing to choreography, he basically fell flat on his
It
face.
was a rough start.
His debut in 1966 was a show called A Joyful Noise. It lasted exactly 12 performances.
Ouch. 12.
Right. And then the very next year, 1967, he choreographed Henry, Sweet Henry.
And that was another commercial failure.
Yep, back-to-back flops.
So he's putting in the hours, taking these massive hits early on. How does someone bounce back from consecutive flops like that to become Broadway royalty?
He kept working and he eventually found the right material. In 1968, everything changes with Promises,
Oh,
Promises.
that was a massive hit.
Huge.
Because you've got this contemporary pop score by Burt Bacharach and Hal David. And the actual story, the book of the musical, is written by Neil Simon.
Yes. And it's here that Bennett's choreography finally gets the praise it deserved. I mean, the show ran for an incredible 1,281 performances.
Wow.
And it featured incredibly well-received production numbers, most notably the famous Turkey Lurkey Time.
Yes, Turkey Lurkey time.
It was kinetic, it was fresh, and he finally had his blockbuster. From there, the momentum just builds.
He earns praise for the play Twigs with Seda Thompson and the musical Coco starring Katharine Hepburn.
Right.
But the real evolution of his unique style starts to emerge when he collaborates with director Hal Prince on two groundbreaking Stephen Sondheim productions.
Follies and Company.
Exactly. Follies, which he co-directed with Prince and Company, which brings us to exactly what made his style so different.
The Bennett signature.
Yeah. Because unlike Bob Fosse, whose hunched jazz hand silhouette is plastered over practically everything he touched, Bennett was somewhat of a chameleon.
He really was.
His signature wasn't a specific physical step, it was psychological. His choreography was entirely motivated by the form of the specific musical and the distinct characters within it.
Exactly. He prioritized character over steps. A brilliant example of this is from Act Two of Company.
Oh, the Hat and Cane routine.
Yes, there is a song called Side by Side. It features this standard, traditional Hat and Cane routine.
Classic Broadway.
Now, a lesser choreographer would have drilled the cast until they look like a flawless, glittering, precision dance team.
Sure, made them look perfect.
But Bennett deliberately defied those expectations. He took the polish off. He literally had the company stumble and miss beats as they worked through the steps.
I mean, that sounds incredibly risky, having a Broadway cast intentionally stumble.
It was a huge gamble.
Weren't the producers terrified the audience would just think they were bad at their jobs?
They probably were terrified. But Bennett understood that if they performed it perfectly, it would just be an empty spectacle.
Right.
By having them stumble, he made the audience hyper aware that this specific group of characters had just been flung together to perform.
That makes a lot of sense.
The number wasn't about showcasing a perfect routine. It was about exposing the flawed characters hiding behind the routine. You're suddenly hyper aware that these are just everyday people in way over their heads.
That is brilliant. It grounds the spectacle in reality.
And this approach was heavily influenced by Jerome Robbins. Bennett recognized early on that Robbins' work was all about totality. Every single element, every sum of a given piece had to add up to a unified whole.
A complete picture.
Yes. For Bennett, the dance couldn't just be a dance break where the story starts. It had to be a continuation of the character's psychological state.
Here's where it gets really interesting.
Yeah.
Because to achieve that level of totality, you need power.
You need a lot of power.
You can't just be the choreographer handing off this scene to a director.
Uh-huh.
And we really see Bennett seize the reins in 1973 with a show called Seesaw.
That was a turning point.
It was a musical by Cy Coleman and Dorothy Fields, and the producers brought Bennett in out of town because the show was ailing.
He was practically dying on its feet.
So what does Bennett do? He doesn't just offer some notes. He demands absolute control.
Total control.
He replaces the original director and the original choreographer. He takes over completely and ends up receiving credit for having written, directed, and choreographed the entire production.
Can you imagine the ego it takes to walk into a failing show and essentially say, "Fire everyone, I'm doing it all myself"?
That's ruthless.
It's completely ruthless. But that moment with Seesaw is the catalyst for the rest of his career. He realizes he needs total authority to execute his vision. And that realization leads directly to his masterpiece, A Chorus Line.
The creation of that show is just fascinating to me because it didn't start with a script at all, did it?
Not at all. It was born out of 20 hours of tape-recorded sessions.
20 hours.
With real Broadway dancers sharing their life stories, their traumas, and their desperate need to perform.
And from what I understand, Bennett wasn't even supposed to be the one running those sessions at first.
No, he was originally invited just to be an observer.
But you put a guy with that kind of drive in a room full of raw emotional material?
His instincts just took over.
He very quickly took charge of the entire process, eventually choreographing it with his lifelong friend Bob Avian and directing the production himself.
And the way A Chorus Line functions is a masterclass in Bennett's philosophy.
How so?
Let's look at the finale number one.
The iconic kick line.
Exactly. It functions so differently than a standard Broadway closer. Throughout the entire musical, the audience has been sitting in on this grueling, psychologically invasive audition.
We've heard these dancers pour their hearts out.
Yes. So when we finally get to the finale, Bennett actually shows the audience the various phases of construction and rehearsal of the dance.
Right. They're in their rehearsal clothes, learning the combinations.
Yes. And by the time they reach that final performance of the routine, they are suddenly all wearing identical, sparkling gold costumes.
It has all that expected dazzling Broadway gloss and polish.
They look like a perfectly unified machine. But because of what we've witnessed for the past 2 hours, Bennett's choreography fundamentally reveals the heavy human cost of that perfection.
The audience sees the gloss, but they feel the pain.
They feel the pain of the individuals who had to erase their own identities to become that unified machine.
It's an incredible bait and switch. You think you're getting a standard kick line, but you're actually getting a tragedy about the erasure of the individual.
And it worked beyond anyone's wildest dreams.
It really did. A Chorus Line debuted off-Broadway in July 1975, moved to Broadway, and won 9 Tony Awards.
Nine.
It won the Pulitzer Prize for Drama in 1976. But that monumental, worldwide success became a massive burden.
It did. Bennett himself later claimed that the global phenomenon of Chorus Line became a hindrance to him.
Because it was everywhere.
There were so many international companies of the musical opening up all over the world, and they all demanded his full-time attention to maintain that unified totality he insisted upon. It consumed him.
And it seems like that need for absolute control didn't translate well outside of the theater.
No, it sabotaged his work in Hollywood.
Right.
He was brought on as a creative consultant for the 1985 film version of A Chorus Line, but he ended up leaving due to creative differences.
He walked away from his own show.
Because Hollywood producers simply were not willing to hand over the kind of total creative influence that he demanded, and he refused to compromise.
So he pivots back to the stage and keeps pushing the boundaries of what a director-choreographer can do.
He never stopped pushing.
In 1981, he directs and co-choreographs Dreamgirls with Michael Peters.
A massive hit.
This was a backstage epic about a Supremes-like girl group. And it tackled really heavy themes like the expropriation of black music by a white recording industry.
Important historical context, yeah.
But what's wild is how he staged it. If you look at reviews and notes from the time, people were calling it this mesmerizing sense of movement.
Because in A Chorus Line, Bennett choreographed the cast,
mm-hmm.
but in Dreamgirls, Bennett essentially choreographed the set.
Wait, so if he isn't choreographing the actors in the traditional sense, how was he creating that momentum? What is he actually moving?
The physical environment itself. The set was dominated by these massive moving plexiglass towers. And Bennett used them to create constantly changing perspectives in space. It was described as an automated ballet.
Automated ballet.
These huge towers would glide across the stage, framing the actors, isolating them, hiding them. The towers energized the action and drove the story forcefully forward.
So the set is basically doing the dancing.
Exactly. Because of this, there were no traditional set piece dance routines in Dreamgirls. The dance and the movement were entirely organic to the action of the set. Bennett literally made the mechanical set his dancers.
That is just brilliant. He took the emotional isolation of the characters and made it physical with these moving walls.
It was revolutionary.
But managing an empire like this, you know, juggling the international companies of A Chorus Line, directing epics like Dreamgirls, it takes a toll, both creatively and financially.
A massive toll.
In 1978, he purchased a massive building at 890 Broadway to convert it into a rehearsal studio complex for dance and theater.
It was supposed to be a haven for creators.
Right.
But by 1986, the financial losses of the property, combined with severe stress-induced angina, forced him to sell the building for $15 million.
That pressure must have been intense.
The pressure on him after 1975 was simply unimaginable. How do you follow up a Pulitzer-winning, culture-defining show like A Chorus Line?
You really can't.
He tried with a project about late-life romance called Ballroom. It garnered 7 Tony nominations, and he won for Best Choreography, but it was financially unsuccessful.
It just couldn't match the hype.
Bennett openly admitted that any project following A Chorus Line was inevitably bound to be an anticlimax.
Which brings us to the really heavy hidden costs of his genius. Because while he was demanding absolute truth and vulnerability from his performers on stage, his own personal life was a maze of secrets and turmoil.
It was very complicated.
Bennett was bisexual, but he took elaborate pains throughout his adult life to ensure the public never suspected he was gay.
Mm-hmm.
He lived a fiercely guarded double life.
He had complex, deeply intertwined personal and professional relationships. In his younger days, he had a relationship with dancer and director Larry Fuller.
Right.
Later, he had a brief marriage to Donna McKechnie, the dancer he had met back on Hullabaloo.
And he created her iconic Tony-winning role in A Chorus Line.
Yes. They married in December 1976. But the pressure was too much. They separated after just a few months and divorced in 1979.
That's so fast.
He also had a highly dramatic affair in the late 70s with Sabine Cassell.
I read about this.
She actually left her family and her husband, the French actor Jean-Pierre Cassell, in Paris to come live with Bennett in Manhattan. But that relationship eventually soured as well.
It sounds like he was constantly searching for a connection, but just couldn't maintain it.
It really does.
And underneath all of this relationship turmoil, the pressure cooker of his career was fueling a really severe battle with substance abuse.
This raises an important question about the dark side of this kind of stratospheric success and what it takes to sustain that level of output.
Yeah.
Bennett developed crippling addictions to alcohol, cocaine, and quaaludes.
It's tragic.
These addictions severely impaired his ability to work and damaged many of his personal and professional relationships. People who worked with him during this period described him as becoming increasingly erratic.
Unpredictable.
Yes. And as his chemical dependency grew, so did a really intense paranoia.
I read about this and it got incredibly dark.
It did.
The stress of his success, mixed with the drugs, created this terrifying delusion. Bennett's paranoia became so intense that he started to believe his massive celebrity, combined with his father's Italian background, made him the target for a mafia hit.
It's heartbreaking.
It really is. He was living in a state of constant fear, looking over his shoulder, convinced he was going to be assassinated.
And then the 1980s arrived, bringing with it a more conservative political climate and the terrifying growing panic of the AIDS epidemic.
Broadway was losing its community at an alarming rate.
Bennett had spent nearly 5 years workshopping a new, sexually daring musical called Scandal.
Oh, with writer Trevor Silverman and songwriter Jimmy Webb.
Exactly. They had poured everything into it. But in 1985, because of that conservative climate and the deep fear surrounding the AIDS crisis, he was forced to abandon the nearly completed project.
5 years of work just gone.
It simply wasn't considered commercially viable anymore. The culture had shifted and it was closing in on him.
And the tragedy just compounded from there. It was also in December of 1985 that Bennett himself was diagnosed with AIDS.
Yes.
And true to form, just as he had hidden his sexuality for his entire career, he carefully disguised his illness from the public. He didn't want the stigma and he didn't want the pity.
But his health began to fail rapidly.
He had been signed to direct the West End production of the musical Chess, but he had to withdraw in January of 1986.
Leaving Trevor Nunn to finish the show using the elaborate sets Bennett had already commissioned.
Right.
She spent the last 8 months of his life having moved far away from the Broadway world he conquered.
Seeking some peace.
He lived in Tucson, Arizona with his last lover, Jean Pruitt, and his friend Bob Hare, receiving care at the University of Arizona Medical Center. Michael Bennett died from AIDS-related lymphoma on July 2, 1987.
He was only 44 years old.
Only 44.
It is staggering to think about what else he might have created if he'd been given more time.
Absolutely. But even in his tragic passing, he left an impact.
He did.
He dedicated a portion of his estate to fund research to fight the pandemic that took his life. He was still trying to direct the outcome, even at the end.
So what does this all mean for you, the listener?
Yeah.
Looking back at all of this history, Bennett's story is a profound lesson in the double-edged sword of total creative control.
It really is.
He achieved greatness by stripping away the artificiality of theater. He forced audiences to look at the exhausted, bruised people behind the curtain. But the human cost of maintaining that perfect artistic vision and juggling the massive empire he built was incredibly high.
And it leaves you with a really complicated thought to chew on. Think about his environment. We know he spent his life hiding his bisexuality and later his devastating illness from the public, constructing this impenetrable facade to protect himself.
Right.
It makes you wonder, if Michael Bennett had lived in a different era, a time where he didn't have to hide who he was, where he didn't have to fear the stigma of his truth, would that same relentless, agonizing drive for total control have even existed?
That is a great question.
Or was his brilliant ability to expose the raw, unvarnished truth of the human condition on stage entirely dependent on the trauma of having to suppress his own?
That is a haunting question.
Right.
Was the genius inextricably linked to the closet he was forced into? It's a heavy contradiction to leave you with today.
It really is.
Thank you for joining us on this deep dive into the life of Michael Bennett. Keep looking for the stories hiding just behind the curtain, and keep questioning the narratives behind the art you consume. We will see you next time.